From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ari Fleischer, probably the least liked White House spokesman since the late Ron Ziegler, announced his resignation this week. And like Ziegler, who was Nixon's mouthpiece, Fleischer has served a president who famously loathes the press. Also like Ziegler, Fleischer is notorious for fabrication, misdirection, and bullying from the podium. Slate columnist Tim Noah has closely followed Fleischer's tenure, and he joins me now from Washington. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First, could you take us through some of Fleischer's signature techniques? You've made a study of what you call his whoppers. Do they follow a pattern?
There's one particular kind of Fleischer whopper that I find particularly impressive. That's when you get caught in a lie, and several months later, you repeat the lie without the slightest bit of shame. And that came up when he was at a press conference and was asked why the president was suddenly in favor of nation building.
During the campaign, the president did not express, as you put it, disdain for nation building. What the president said is the military should be used for the purpose of fighting and winning wars, exactly as we did in Afghanistan. And then there are other areas of the government that actively are involved, should be involved, and will be involved in nation building.
He bluffed, saying that Bush was only against nation building when it was done by the military. And that turned out not to be true. Bush had said in one of the presidential debates that he was against nation building by the military and by civilian authorities. Fleischer said this completely deadpan, got called on it, and then several months later repeated it completely deadpan once again.
You know, oddly enough, what's been cited as one of Fleischer's most recent whoppers, that about the president's costly photo op helicopter landing on an aircraft carrier, you defend. Now, Fleischer said the landing was necessary because the carrier was going to be hundreds of miles away, when in reality it was only maybe a few dozen miles away. But you say it's all right.
He was accused of lying, but in this case, I believe his explanation. He said that, yes, when I told you, the press, that it was hundreds of miles offshore, it was. Then, by the time the event actually took place, it was only 30 miles offshore. This was pointed out that day to the president. I'm paraphrasing here. Mm-hmm. But he was so wedded to the idea of flying the plane that he said, let's do it anyway. Now, it seems to me that if that were a lie, it wouldn't be a very clever lie, because it basically seeds the larger point that the press was trying to make, which was that this photo op was going to cost taxpayers unnecessary money. And it also switches blame from himself, Fleischer, to his boss, the president, which is something a press secretary is never supposed to do. And I think this is a sign maybe that Fleischer is losing his touch. He started to blurt out the truth, and maybe he figures that that means it's time to go.
And this inadvertent truth-telling happened more than once, too. One of Fleischer's remarks, which he has since admitted that he does regret, I think has to do with inadvertent truth-telling. This is the one in which he said regarding the cost of war in Iraq that it would be more cost-effective to dispatch Saddam with a single bullet. This is an impalatable assertion, but a direct one that we could easily imagine Donald Rumsfeld making.
Again, the president has not made any decisions about what military option he might pursue. I can only say that the cost of a one-way ticket is substantially less than that. The cost of one bullet, if the Iraqi people take it on themselves, is substantially less than that. The cost of war is more than that.
That was impolitic, but obviously reflected the thoughts of the administration, and I think probably lots of people in the United States as well. It was very bad manners, however.
What would you say was Ari Fleischer's signature moment at the podium?
I think it was when he said that people better watch what they say. I'm not sure if those are the precise words, but this was after the comedian Bill Maher had, on his television show Politically Incorrect, said that he didn't think that the 9/11 attackers were accurately described as cowardly, as the president had said. He pointed out that cowardice and evil are not the same things. It's a point I actually quite agree with and had written myself before, but it seemed to really raise Fleischer's hackles. And he said, people better watch what they say. which was really pretty creepy.
You know, it seems to me that relates to what is actually one of my favorite Fleischer techniques, which is to take moral umbrage at an inconvenient question. In this clip, a reporter is asking whether the White House is horse trading with nations to get support for the war in Iraq. And what he says here is that, that question suggests that nations are buyable.
Think about the implications of what you're saying. You're saying that the leaders of other nations are buyable, and that is not an acceptable proposition. Thank you.
The first time he's laughed off the stage. What do you think about that answer?
That's definitely a signature of the Bush administration, to sort of portray the press as this alien group that has no morals, no ethics, and is given to asking questions that no decent person would ever raise.
Are you familiar with Russell McIver?
Yes, I am. He works for a newsletter, I believe, that focuses on corporate crime. And he is constantly asking Fleischer questions that betray a somewhat leftist anti-business sensibility. And this is deeply, deeply offensive to Fleischer.
Like a mosquito buzzing around Ari Fleischer's head. He says, why do you hire war criminals for your administration, vis-a-vis Kissinger? Why do you hire convicted felons, Elliot Abrams? And he'll just keep peppering him with these same questions. My impression is McIver was just waiting for Ari's head to literally explode.
Well, I guess he's robbing him of that opportunity by quitting now.
Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Noah writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.com. Now, Russell McIver, as we mentioned, has made a career of annoying Ari Fleischer. Let's play this clip of him harassing the press secretary about stepping down.
I was wondering, is there anything President Bush has done as president that made you think, even for a moment, that you would resign as a matter of conscience?
No.
Not for a moment.
Why should there be?
Russell McIver is the editor of the Washington, D.C.-based corporate crime reporter, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I understand that one thing that you particularly object to is how closely Fleischer enforces the policy regarding the conduct of the media at the daily press briefings. Do you try and just sort of disrupt this protocol because you find it too constraining?
No, actually, he does. There are 8 rows in the press briefing room. And he says that he doesn't want to go out of order. But often when he doesn't like a question that was asked by a reporter from a previous day or previous week, he'll violate his own rule and just skip over the reporter, even though the reporter has his or her hand up and wants to ask a question. So there's a number of ways that he can get around a reporter asking a question. One is just to skip over them. Another is to leave the reporter waiting at the gate outside, which has happened to me on many occasions. Something's wrong with the computer, you're not being cleared in. And the third way is just to prohibit reporters' access.
This hasn't happened just to you, though, has it? This sort of selective exclusion?
Ari knows when the press briefing is being broadcast on CNN and on the major cable networks. So I think often that's when it happens. When the cable networks are on and carrying the event live, he will skip over reporters that he knows will give him a hard time.
It's known that Ari has not shrunk from warning reporters when they've stepped over the line. Have you ever come under that kind of pressure or scrutiny?
When I first started covering the White House, he called me and he said that he thought that my questions portrayed the president as being affiliated with criminals and white-collar crooks. And I told him, well, I'm the editor of a publication called Corporate Crime Reporter. This is my beat. That was a way that he was trying to send me a message. Subsequently, I went through this whole ordeal where he, in fact, banned me for a couple months. And when I got in, you know, just skipped over me when he didn't want to deal with it.
So now that your adversary is stepping down, are you going to miss him even a little bit?
Well, what we can say about Ari is that he's very good at what he does, which is be the minister of disinformation and make sure that reporters don't get to him. And I think it can be said that reporters never really got to him. So I can't say that it's a sad day that he's going. But on the other hand, his successor is going to have a more difficult time with the White House press. And I think that was shown when Scott McClellan, his perhaps successor, briefed the press corps when he was gone last Friday. and the press were starting to jump all over him. My wife, when I told her this, thought that it was like when the substitute teacher takes over and the kids just gang up on the substitute. That's going to be happening because no one's going to be able to fill his shoes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Russell Mokyber is the editor of the Washington, D.C.-based Corporate Crime Reporter, and despite his best efforts, he never got to Ari Fleischer.
And now for a few of your letters. On our coverage of the upcoming FCC vote on media deregulation, Elliot Mitchell had this to say: if there ever was evidence that media concentration is a bad idea, look only at the dearth of coverage on the consolidation issue before the FCC. And Mr. Mitchell notes that in our discussion last week, we left out how the commission counts penetration of UHF stations. He writes, they're discounted, you know, and if a media company invests heavily in UHF stations, which many of the Fox stations are, the market coverage is skewed in favor of the owners, not the viewers.
And Jessica Randall writes that she's heard a lot about deregulation, but still wonders, whom does it benefit? At this point in time, if someone doesn't like specific programming, they can always tune into something else. With less diversification, that will become harder to do. For an institution that upon its founding was declared a public domain, this maneuver seems unjust and unfounded.
Mark and Kathy Sondheim wrote in to praise our interview with Mark Bernstein, co-author of World War II on the Air, which includes a CD of highlights from the reporting of Edward R. Murrow and his so-called Murrow's Boys. They write that they, quote, were certainly aware of Murrow, but not really the significance of what he had done.
And finally, this from Dale Heltzer. The earth shudders, buildings tilt on their foundations as flights of birds crash into glinting window panes and vast swarms of locusts obscure the sun. I noted a week ago that OTM was a whole half minute shorter than usual, the precious 30 seconds given over to additional underwriting announcements. What in the name of all that is holy is happening? Please tell me that you are not being slowly and inexorably devoured by the corporate sponsorship Leviathan.
Yeah, as if. We're not exactly buried in corporate sponsors around here, but thanks for caring and for your letters. Keep sending them to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, more on the Bush administration's inspired media management, a tug of war over Iraqi TV, and a rescue reconsidered.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When presidential joyrider George W. Bush tail-hooked onto the carrier USS Abraham Lincoln recently, much was made of the stage management behind his dramatic high seas landing, in which presidential security took a backseat to presidential image. Elizabeth Buemiller, White House correspondent for the New York Times, recently chronicled the many ways this administration has crafted presidential must-see TV. She joins me now. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right, let's begin with the aircraft carrier landing earlier this month because it so infuriated so many people. But you've been watching the PR handling of this president for a while now. Were you surprised by the so-called Top Gun event?
in our newsroom at the Times who were saying, my God, this is the biggest spectacle of presidential theater we've ever seen. If you have been watching the Bush White House for the last 2 years, you can see in some ways that they were really building up to it. They haven't, you know, invented the wheel here. They have just added on to a lot of, if you can call them, White House tricks and methods of staging the president that's been going on since Ronald Reagan, really.
I guess the jury is out and will remain out until history judges whether President Bush was a good or a bad president. But we don't have to wait to determine that he's probably the best lighted president who ever served in the White House. Tell me about the Musco lights.
I guess you could say that. Musco lights are the giant sort of Klieg lights you see at movie premieres and at outdoor sporting events, sports stadiums, rock concerts. And for a couple of really big events, the White House rented these lights at a cost that I could not determine and used them to do some pretty dramatic stuff. The main thing that people remember in America was on the one-year anniversary of September 11th. President Bush gave a speech on Ellis Island, and the White House had gone so far as to rent three sets of Musco lights, which they sent out on a barge across New York Harbor and tethered in the water around the base of Liberty Island and then sort of blasted them upward and lit up the Statue of Liberty in a huge, fabulous way so it could be seen on television.
You mentioned the Reagan administration. Michael Deaver was widely credited with turning the routine business of making the president look good into a sort of high art. But even he has looked with admiration at the work of the current administration. Who are the people behind the scenes who are making President Bush look so presidential?
I guess you could call them Deaver's children. Interestingly, all of them have previous network television experience. The first among equals is a young man named Scott Sforza, who used to be a producer at ABC. There's another guy named Bob DeServi. He was an NBC cameraman during the 2000 Bush campaign. The Bush people liked his work so much that he was hired when this administration began to do all the lighting for President Bush. There's a new guy who's head of the presidential advance team. The presidential advance is the group of people that sets up all the presidential events 2, 3, 4, 5 days ahead of time. He was a producer for Fox News. So they hired some of the best in the business. And what's interesting is that this is all technical, a lot of it, but it turns out that making the president look really good does come down many days to camera angles and lighting and staging and backdrops.
What about the subtle and not so subtle altering of reality? There was a speech in Indianapolis in which the president was trying to demonstrate that his proposed tax cuts would benefit the working man.
There was a report on a local television station in Indianapolis where local Republican leaders told the television reporter that the White House people had asked some of the Republican officials sitting behind the president, who would be seen on television, to remove their ties. And the idea was they didn't want it to look formal, that they wanted the people to look, you know, more like ordinary folk who might be benefiting from the president's tax cut, or so the president was saying.
At some point, maybe I'm just oversensitive, doesn't this take on a sort of Leni Riefenstahl echo to it, the documentation of the heroism of the Reich? At some point, doesn't it get close to just too much?
I don't perhaps think it's as dangerous as you think it is. I just think it's American politics. To be a successful politician, you have to be good on television. We've known that for many decades now.
No, see, I wouldn't say dangerous. I would just say vaguely creepy at taxpayer expense.
Well, I'm not going to say that. I don't know. What is the alternative? If you're the president, you know, and you're going to be on television, they got to shine a light on you because otherwise you're not going to be seen. Where would you draw the line? Do you not do a stage for the president? You know, I don't know where the line is.
You know, I don't know where the line is either, but I have a sneaking suspicion that somewhere, maybe in this presidency and maybe in the last one, it has been crossed. Elizabeth Buemiller, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Buemiller covers the White House for the New York Times. While military victory in Iraq was swift, the managing of the peace is more problematic in the development of the media, as everywhere else. Last week, a U.S.-funded TV station called the Iraqi Media Network went on the air in Baghdad, but without the live news programs originally planned, and amid charges of American meddling in basic journalism. Among other matters at issue, according to Reuters correspondent Saul Hudson, an attempt to censor passages from the Quran and a demand that new programs be reviewed by the wife of a prominent Kurdish leader.
They felt that this was just a form of political censorship. They said that no Western media would be asked to have their news items scrutinized by a political leader before they went on air.
What's the programming look like on the Iraqi Media Network at the moment?
It looks a bit simple and perhaps a little dated. You have music, which almost underlines the idea that perhaps some of the programming is dated because the music is from an era of decades ago. And then you have canned interviews with a low-ranking official. Plus, you have vox pop interviews with people lining outside a hospital, for example, or people at gas stations, and no comment from the journalist. So it appears that it's just a hodgepodge of different views. So it has a rather pedestrian feel to it at the moment.
Okay, so on the face of it, it would seem a little ironic that after the liberation of Iraq and in preparation for democracy there, the United States' first act would be to put some sort of broadcast restraints on free expression through the airwaves. But is it as simple as that apparent irony?
There is a fine line that the Americans have to walk, and what they are saying is that this is the birth of a new era of television, and it is not very easy to get up and running. They say that it isn't propaganda. The challenge that the American administration has is to convince the viewers of the station's credibility when the Iraqis are automatically assuming that the station is only there to put out an American message and not necessarily an Iraqi message.
Only 10% of Iraqis even own a television set, so the stakes are perhaps not as high as they might be in another country, another situation. But nonetheless, the station isn't the only one available to Iraqis.
They do have other options. Kurds in the north of Iraq have a station whose transmissions get picked up in different parts of the country. The main diet of television news in Baghdad is actually an Iranian television station, which can be picked up. However, Iraqis watching it would always comment that they were seeing what they were seeing through the prism of Iranian eyes and not through Iraqi eyes. They seemed very prepared to just filter out aspects of it that they thought might have an Iranian bias.
Now, the people you spoke to seem strikingly media savvy, considering they've been subject only to Saddam's propaganda for the last several decades.
I believe that the Iraqis view all television with a skeptical eye, because they had years and years of listening to broadcasts that they didn't completely believe in. And so it was a very simple question for them. Where is this television coming from, and therefore where is its bias?
So if a diplomatically cunning and yet reasonably balanced news station lands in the forest and nobody bothers turning on the television, does it make a noise?
It seems at the moment as if the other stations are making more noise. And then you have to go back to the point you made about how many people have television sets. It seems that newspapers can have more of an influence at the moment than television because of the lack of electricity. And unfortunately for Iraqis, the thing that appears to make most noise is rumor. Word of mouth spreads from perhaps a kernel of truth and goes around a city and then around a country, so that in fact credible information is very difficult to come by because rumor is filling the void where the television stations might eventually be.
All right. Well, Saul Hudson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Reuters correspondent Saul Hudson just returned from Baghdad and spoke to us heroically while recovering from root canal surgery.
We all know the inspiring story of the rescue of Private Jessica Lynch, as told by Brigadier General Vincent Brooks.
It was a classic joint operation done by some of our nation's finest warriors who are dedicated to never leaving a comrade behind.
American media resounded with accounts of her broken limbs and bullet wounds, her fight to the death, and how her comrades rushed in under fire to save her from brutal captors. She made it home alive. That last, certainly most important part, is true. She is alive. Of the rest, we are no longer certain.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thank you for watching us tonight. Somebody's lying in a big way.
Fox News personality Bill O'Reilly is angry because of an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times. The piece picked up on the suggestion of a BBC documentary that aired last weekend that Jessica's recovery was not as first reported. The program covers the same ground as earlier reports in the Times of London, the Toronto Sun, the Washington Post, and elsewhere. It cites Iraqi doctors who say Jessica had no bullet wounds, an account backed up by military doctors in Germany, that she received the best care that beleaguered hospital could provide, including blood donations from the medical staff, and that there were no soldiers in or near the hospital. They say the Rambo-like tactics of the American soldiers were, frankly, inexplicable.
We saw surprise at that time. Why they do this? There is no military, no Iraqi soldier in the hospital.
Like a film of Hollywood, they cry and go, 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 shout, go, 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 with guns.
Yeah, it's outrageous. I'm on national television. I should calm down.
Colonel David Hunt on the O'Reilly Factor.
To assail the finest operators in the world, the people did this. Well, let's get into it.
NBC has acquired from an Iraqi lawyer an account of the rescue that reflects the Pentagon's version, but you're not likely to see the BBC's take on events, called Saving Private Jessica, Fact or Fiction. Its producer, Sandy Smith, joins me from London. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So how did the British media cover the Jessica Lynch story initially? Was it so very different from the way the U.S. media covered it?
It wasn't as big a story in the UK as it was in America. There was definitely awareness in the British press when it broke that this was very much an American show and that it was a good news story at a time when there wasn't much good news on the ground. The BBC actually made that point right at the very beginning.
That the rescue occurred during a particularly low point in the war.
And that the story appeared to be destined for folklore, if you like.
I thought one of the telling points in your film was when you solicited the reaction of the Pentagon spokesman Brian Whitman to the skepticism over Jessica's rescue.
Was there any resistance as the forces were going in?
I think that I will leave that story to be told in great detail when the time is right.
We went to the Pentagon and said, look, you know, there's a different story emerging. Is there anything you'd like to tell us? Would you like to rebut what people are saying at the hospital? And in particular, would you like to show us more of the footage that you shot when you were in the hospital? And the defensive way in which Brian Whitman dealt with it and the refusal to release more of the tape, I think, did them no favors, because had they turned around with a very strong rebuttal of what the Iraqi doctors had said, then, on balance, we would have to have reconsidered what we were able to say. But for an organization which did so much news management during the war, they weren't very nimble on their feet when this issue hit them.
You know, Bill O'Reilly, host of a Fox News Channel show, dismissed your documentary with a flick of the wrist. He said, oh, the BBC, well, you know, they have a credibility issue. They're terribly anti-war. And he also questioned why we should believe the Iraqi doctors over our own troops. And he's not alone in that criticism. What do you say to him?
I think you have to ask what their motivation is. I mean, they're in a country which has been liberated by the Americans. Their hospital is full of war wounded. It's short of drugs. The smart thing to do would be to cozy up to the occupying forces in the hopes of getting some medical workers, some drugs into the hospital. You know, I see no motivation for them. You know, we presented both sides of this story and, in a sense, you know, let the discrepancies hang in the air. I mean, the real story, sadly, was that 9 Americans lost their lives and that many of them were recovered from shallow graves during the same operation in which she was recovered. But the skillful way in which it was presented and the appetite that the American media had for it meant that all we ever remembered was Jessica, not the fact that there had been a large loss of life. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That, you know, propaganda has always played a part in war. But I think it's the duty of responsible broadcasters when the conflict is over to say, hang on a minute, maybe some of the things we said at the time weren't quite right.
Your documentary has gotten some coverage in the United States. It has been cited in some stories. But generally, the story of Jessica Lynch's rescue revisited has not hit the front pages in the United States. Now, partly it's because the war is over. But I wonder whether you think there may be another reason why there's no great rush to correct the record.
What Jessica Lynch played to was the overwhelming feeling of relief in America that we were doing okay, it wasn't as bad as it looked like it was going to be at one point, and we were going to come out of this war with our reputation intact and with our goals achieved. So I can quite see why there's not an appetite in the States for going back and what some people might say was nitpicking, because, you know, let's face it, Jessica Lynch had a terrible time. You know, she nearly died. A lot of her colleagues did. She came back alive. That is the most important thing. And I hope no one connected with Jessica Lynch or her family would think that the BBC in any way was seeking to, you know, underplay her extraordinary personal story. But I did detect in some of the negative press, possibly from Fox or whatever, that re-examining this stuff and asking difficult questions of people like Brian Whitman, you know, strange as it may seem, is somehow to ignore the difficult personal story that she had. I'm not apologizing for it. I'm glad we did it, and we'll go on doing it in wars to come.
Well, Sandy Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sandy Smith is the producer of the BBC documentary called Saving Private Jessica, Fact or Fiction. 2 days after the rescue, the Washington Post ran a cover story with the headline, She Was Fighting to the Death, Details Emerging of Soldiers' Capture and Rescue. In the following weeks, those emerging details contradicted the original story, but most of them were buried deep within the paper. The scattering of facts left Post columnist Richard Cohen confused and dissatisfied with his paper's coverage.
I don't know what's going on. It may just be that the original report was false and you know, somebody at the Pentagon got it wrong. Maybe somebody at the Pentagon spun it. All I know is, as a reader, I'm confused by what happened. What bothered me was that there wasn't a single story that came right out and said either the first story was wrong, or we don't know anymore what the truth is, or we have reason to doubt it. But, you know, it's an example, it seems to me, of the press, and I single out the Washington Post here, but it's representative, of simply not being able to say to the reader, we don't know anymore, you know, just less what you might say to a friend.
Up next, a media success in El Salvador and a journalist's defeat in Zimbabwe.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For many news organizations, the struggle for journalistic objectivity is a matter of subtle tinkering, adjusting a slight bias this way or that. But for Radio Victoria, a station born in rebel territory in rural El Salvador during that country's civil war, politics are never subtle. Sharon Lerner reports.
Ho Che and Lola Lieva and their five children have no television, no phone, no running water, and iffy electricity. The family does have a radio, though, which sits in their open-air kitchen surrounded by chickens. And in Santa Marta, a small village of subsistence farmers in the northern mountains of El Salvador, that makes them lucky. The Lieva's favorite station is Radio Victoria.
Radio Victoria, 92.1 FM
stereo.
For me, it's very useful because I like listening to the news. It's where you can get an idea of developments at the local and provincial level.
When it first began 10 years ago, Radio Victoria was broadcast out of a mud brick home right here in Santa Marta. El Salvador's brutal civil war had just ended, but the country was still deeply divided, with the leftist FMLN pitted against the right-wing Arena Party. Santa Marta had been settled just a few years earlier by FMLN fighters like Ho Che, who were returning from refugee camps in Honduras. Christina Starr, who is from Vermont, helped found the community station, which is in the county of Victoria.
The radio was not started specifically to be an FMLN radio, but it's always, you know, in the beginning it was looked at. Victoria only saw Santa Marta as being a guerrilla place. You know, so if the radio came from Santa Marta, obviously it was a guerrilla radio.
Within a year, the station moved to a better building in the county seat. But it's proven easier to physically relocate the station than to change perceptions of its politics. In 1994, during the first elections after the El Salvadoran peace accords, some on the right feared that Radio Victoria and other community stations would use their frequencies to promote the left's FMLN candidates.
So the president of the telecommunication company, who just also at that time happened to be the president of the right-wing Arena Party, in December of 1995 sent out a order to the National Civilian Police to raid our radios and take our equipment.
The local police did remove the station's transmitter, and Radio Victoria went off the air for weeks until the country's Supreme Court declared the seizure unconstitutional. After it went back on the air, the station decided to be less partisan in order to broaden its audience. Now Radio Victoria runs paid ads and editorials from candidates from all parties. It no longer allows the FMLN to hold local chapter meetings at its offices. And the station also focuses on stories of local interest. Guillermo Erasmo Chavez is coordinator of the news department.
Por ejemplo, durante el Mitch, sí, serios problemas. Por ejemplo,
during Hurricane Mitch, there were serious problems. For example, the farmers of basic grains lost their entire crop. We did a few campaigns here, telling people that if they had beans, to donate them to people who didn't have them. And people from other villages that had produced a lot brought big quantities to those who had nothing.
Perhaps what endears Radio Victoria most to its listeners are the personal notices or avisos that airs daily. In an area with few telephones, avisos are a critical means of communication.
Sí, en esta mañana quiero aprovechar de avisarle a todos los repobladores de Santa Marta que voy a bajar hoy a las 4 de la tarde a la casa de Don Bonifacio.
In this aviso, a man wearing the cowboy hat and machete typical of local farmers has come into the station to announce a meeting that will take place in a few hours. As for the location, he says only Bonifacio's house in Santa Marta, assuming listeners will know where that is. Other avisos announce deaths in the community, or that Jose is heading down the hill with a truck soon, and could Juan please meet him with a mule? For some, the purpose of El Salvador's 24 local community stations, of which Radio Victoria is one, is to give voice to poor locals who would not otherwise be heard. 23-year-old Manuel Navarrete has worked at Radio Victoria since he was 16 and now hosts a weekly popular music program, Canto a la Vida.
These are stations that differ from government stations, which are on the other side of the sector, the right.
They say whatever is most convenient to them. They say things like the country doesn't have any problems. Community radio tries to show the other face of the coin, trying to talk about the realities that the country faces, the great problems before us.
On a recent hot Sunday afternoon, a shirtless Navarrete sat in Radio Victoria's broadcasting booth, wrapping up the latest segment of his show. Outside the station, it's not uncommon to find Manuel in his red FMLN t-shirt. But after a recent shakeup, he's making an effort to keep his political views separate from his radio work. Anyone who knows Manuel, and that's pretty much everyone in Santa Marta, knows his politics. His father, who now farms corn and beans, was an FMLN guerrilla fighter. Two of his siblings died during the war, one as an FMLN combatant. And Manuel, who plays the guitar and sings, has even written songs for the party. Proclamations of political loyalty are not uncommon in a country where people sometimes paint their party colors on their cow fences. But Canto a la Vida is billed as a musical show, not a political one.
I play music that practically was all made during the conflict and written by guerrilla groups. It was music that reflected the thoughts and feelings of the people. They had prohibited me from playing these songs, and whenever I put them on, there was some concern about the outside image of the station. They feared it would be seen as taking sides on this or that issue.
At first, Manuel resisted the request not to play guerrilla songs and decided to take his show off the air in protest. Rumors spread that he was being censored, and an all-staff meeting was held to discuss the situation. Ultimately, he agreed not to play songs that made overt political references, and the fracas died down. Canto a la Vida is back on the air now. The elections are over. In Victoria's mayoral race, the right-wing Arena candidate won. But Radio Victoria's political struggle continues. Christina Starr.
One of our reporters belongs to the Arena Party, and she was elected to, like, the youth committee of her town. And so we've had to talk to them and say, you know, either you're with the radio or you're with the political party. You can't be doing both things.
Back on the mountain, Jorge Lieva hears none of that internal effort.
The station's only agenda is social. It has no political colors. If a person wants to make an announcement, they can do it perfectly on Radio Victoria, regardless of their party.
Perhaps, for Lieva, Radio Victoria really has achieved the elusive goal of objectivity. Or maybe it's enough that his local station tries to ferret the truth from the messy passions that rule his country.
YSNX, Radio Victoria, 92.1 FM Stereo.
For On the Media, I'm Sharon Lerner.
For 23 years, the entirety of Robert Mugabe's presidency, journalist Andrew Meldrum has lived and worked in Zimbabwe. In the early years, Meldrum chronicled the tribulations of a fledgling African democracy. In the past few years, he has documented President Mugabe's increasing and increasingly violent destruction of democratic institutions. For this, he has earned the enmity of the government in a year of legal and extra-legal intimidation, culminating a week ago in his abduction and expulsion from Zimbabwe. He had been the last foreign correspondent in the country and thus the last journalistic link between the Zimbabwean dictatorship and the West. He joins me now from London. Andrew, once again, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
Why don't we begin with you telling me what your last 7 days has been like?
What happened was security agents came to our gate at our house to pick me up. My wife said I wasn't there. They said they would wait. It was four men in four vehicles, including a large van with blacked out windows. My lawyer and I went to immigration offices, and at that meeting I was served with deportation orders, and police surrounded me, took me out. And actually, as I spoke to the press that was assembled there, telling them what was happening, they dragged me away, kicking, punching, shoving. put me in a car. In the car, they put a hood over my head and thumped me on the back and said, the time for games is over. And I had interviewed many people, including members of parliament for the opposition party, who the same hood had been put over their head, and they were invariably taken to police stations in rural areas, and they were beaten and tortured with electric shock. And I was understandably worried that that might happen to me. But instead, they drove me around for a while and then took me to the airport. After holding me in the basement of the airport for 10 hours, they then put me on a plane to London, and I have been doing interviews and things like that about the situation.
You were the last foreign correspondent left in Zimbabwe before you were kidnapped and chucked out. How is it possible that kicking you out of the country under such public circumstances could be better for Mugabe than simply to have suffered you silently while you remained there reporting?
You're right. They gave themselves a black eye. To haul me off in front of cameras and film crews and journalists, publicly mishandling me, was not the way to silence me. It actually gave me a greater platform. And also, I think I was a symbol of the remainders of a free press in Zimbabwe. And they think that by taking me away in a frightening manner, they are going to frighten the remaining Zimbabwean journalists who write for both the foreign media and for the local press to stop being independent and critical. And I can tell you that they're not going to do that. And for that matter, I'm not going to stop publishing as much as I can on Zimbabwe either.
In the 23 years of Mugabe's reign in Zimbabwe, he has mutated from being a democratic hero to an authoritarian democrat, if such a thing can exist, to what is clearly now pure dictatorship, notwithstanding the superficial existence of a constitution and branches of government. Is it that Mugabe has further mutated into a lunatic?
Well, I think that he's under a great deal of pressure. The wheels are coming off in Zimbabwe in a big way. There's inflation of 230%, unemployment reaching 70%, food shortages. There's a shortage of gasoline, so that you must wait in line for maybe as much as 5 days to get a full tank of gas. Robert Mugabe is not coming up with any answers to those problems, and instead what he's doing is lashing out, I think, irrationally, and proof of that is what they did to me.
I saw the two pieces that you've done in the last few days in The Guardian about your experience in being expelled from Zimbabwe. And if I had to characterize the tone, I would say somewhere between plaintive and infuriated, and less the work of a journalist than of an activist. Have you yourself mutated into something other than an objective journalist by virtue of what you've endured for the last two decades?
Oh, I don't think so at all. What I am talking about is the need for a free press in Zimbabwe, the need for respect for human rights in the country, and the need for democracy. As far as I'm concerned, those are basic universal principles that any objective person could say they support, and therefore I think any objective journalist can say they support that as well.
One final question, Andrew. In our past conversations, you have maintained some sort of guarded optimism that Robert Mugabe's behavior will eventually get the attention of the international community to the point that somehow it comes to an end. Do you feel naive now for harboring those hopes?
No, Bob, I actually still have that guarded optimism and that determination and confidence that, in fact, Zimbabwe will be returned to democracy. So I guess you just must call me stubborn.
Well, Andrew, as always, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and as always, all best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Meldrum is a reporter for The Guardian. He spoke to us from its office in London.
Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Chris Hedges hates war, though he used to love it. In an interview with us last December, he spoke of the adrenaline rush, the camaraderie, the exalted detachment from ordinary life.
It's a kind of addiction. You know, I jumped from war to war to war for almost two decades. It was no accident that I was covering the war in Kosovo with people I had covered the war in Central America with 20 years before.
But after so many blood-soaked stories had run through his pen onto the pages of the Times, Hedges found it harder to stay in that rarefied warrior moment. He felt boxed in by self-awareness and the history he'd witnessed. Where once he saw nobility and sacrifice, he saw self-interest and futility. He swore off war reporting and wrote a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Last Saturday, he returned to his alma mater, Rockford College in Illinois, to give the commencement address, and he spoke against the war in Iraq. It's often been said that since 9/11, the rights we cherish and seek to extend are coming under increasing pressure at home. Hedges told the students at Rockford College that the government and the media had colluded in crafting a glorious image of war, suffused with patriotism and cleansed of death.
We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love. The ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity is real. But this is part of war's intoxication.
His speech was not well received. Twice his mic was cut off, crowd members turned their backs on him, jeered, used foghorns, jumped threateningly onto the stage, the college president intervened. When Hedges finally concluded, campus security accompanied him off the stage. The Rockford Register Star ran with the headline, "Speaker Disrupts RC Graduation." Speaker disrupts graduation? Hedges' speech sent two potent messages to graduates that day. He told them to resist war fever because in its heat we can lose ourselves, our sense of individual responsibility. By its actions, the crowd showed the consequences for American freedom of succumbing.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Blake Carlton. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.